Turning our attention now to The Driftless Land. That is the title of a book that we, and we're actually right now trying to get a hold of Kevin Koch, professor of English at Loras College in Dubuque, Iowa. He's the author of The Driftless Land. And it's kind of a search for the spirit of place among the bluffs, the woodlands, and the prairies of the upper Mississippi River Valley. These are pretty rugged lands among the prairies, and they're known as the Driftless Area. And what's the Driftless Area? Well, it's about, I think it's about a 20,000 square mile region of southwest and central Wisconsin, covers northeast Iowa, covers northwest Illinois, covers southeast Minnesota. And Kevin Koch has written a book about it, and he is, I said, a professor of English at Loras College. He's in Dubuque, Iowa, and the book is published by Southeast Missouri State University Press, and we have him with us now, so it's great to have him along here today to talk about his book and about his writing, and to talk, certainly, about the Upper Mississippi Valley and this Driftless Area, because it's a great area. We've had a show or two lately about the Driftless Area, and I think it's great. And I hope you'll call in with your questions and comments as we move along today. Maybe you have questions about the Driftless Area, or what about a spirit of place? What have you got to say about that? What questions do you have? So, join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And let me see if I got him on here. I've got him on. I'm trying to get him on. Kevin, are you with us?
Yes, Kevin Koch.
Yes. Hi, Kevin. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, and sorry about the delay.
Oh, no problem, no problem at all. The Driftless, how did you come to write this book?
Well, I grew up in the Dubuque area, and I've always felt that that this is a particularly beautiful part of the country, and I'm not sure that that story is quite known, both outside of this area, and even within this area. I think we're sort of a soft-spoken people in the Midwest, and perhaps maybe not even quite aware of the beauty that this area has.
Yeah, and so you took some time from work. Talk about that process.
Well, I teach full-time at Loras College, and so writing a book is a long process. I started the book back, I believe, in about 2004 with the first essay, which was about the Savannah Army Depot, just about 30 miles south of Dubuque. And then over the next couple of semesters and years, added a couple more pieces about different places in the area, Cincinnati, Wisconsin, et cetera. And pretty soon it occurred to me that there was a pattern here, and I wanted to tell the story of the area in general. So in spring of 2008, I was generously granted a sabbatical to continue working on the book that I had started. And just had a wonderful opportunity to spend the semester not only just writing, but to get out to various places around the countryside. Had the chance to trace the route of the Black Hawk War for about 500 miles in February of that year, to go out in the river with John Strawvers from the Audubon Society, just a whole bunch of experiences like that, where I had a chance to get out in the field with a field ranger or someone like that who could really tell me the story of the land.
And it's really an interesting land. And I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with the Driftless area, but maybe you could go into a little bit more detail about, all right, what is the Driftless area? Here we've got 20,000 square mile region Why is it called the Driftless Area?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the short answer is that this is the area that the glaciers, in a sense, bypassed. Now, the glaciers occurred over, hundreds of thousands of years, and they were in different periods. So sometimes they stopped a little short. Sometimes they swung past on the west. Sometimes they swung on the east and underneath. But in general, the glaciers missed this particular area. And it's called Driftless because there's no or very little glacial drift found in this area. So what you have, the ruggedness of the land in the area I'm talking about is southwest and central Wisconsin, southeast Minnesota, northeast Iowa, and northwest Illinois. And so the reason that that area is so rugged compared to the flatter or rolling hills around it is because this is what the land was like prior to the onslaught of the multiple glaciers.
And it's really created some beautiful areas, hasn't it?
It really is, yes. Mm-hmm.
You write, each chapter is kind of an essay about a particular spot in the Driftless area, but you talk about the spirit of place in your book, and you say that you won't really know the spirit of place until you've walked slowly and attentively through locations like what the Kickapoo Valley Reserve or maybe the Trempealeau Mountain. Talk about what do you mean there?
Mm-hmm. In one of the essays that's called "Where the Earth Breathes." The point I make there pretty pointedly, and it's near the end of the book, and I've alluded to it throughout, is that no matter where we reside at a particular time, because we are a very mobile society, I'm probably one of the unusual people who has pretty much lived his entire life in one area, but no matter where we are, I think it's really important to find out about that particular place, to study it, the human history, why, when did the first Native Americans arrive, when did pioneers arrive, and why, but also the history of the land. Why are there rock outcroppings in this particular place, and why is there a sharp valley here, and 20 miles from here there's flatland? So I also think it's important to know those things, but then I think there's another layer that in order to know the spirit of place, you just need to be out there and to, experience firsthand the landscape that you're walking through. And in the essay "Where the Earth Breathes," where that line comes from, I was out hiking in the wintertime in a woods near my house, and I came across what I call a vertical shaft, a cave shaft, essentially sinkhole that has a true cave beneath it. And in those cases, you often have, in the wintertime, some warm air that's arising up out of the shaft. And it's very subtle. You wouldn't necessarily feel it. But I took a handful of powdery snow, threw it across the opening, and it just blew it up like it was confetti. And I thought, you aren't going to know those places where the earth breathes unless you really just, you're out there and in contact with it.
You have to get out of the house.
Yeah, absolutely.
Kevin Koch, our guest today, we're talking with him about his book. The title of the book is "The Driftless Land, Spirit of Place in the Upper Mississippi Valley." Pleased to have him with us today. And certainly if you have questions about this area or questions about his writing, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I like the book in part because you talk about some areas that I'm not at all familiar with. One of those areas is the Whitewater Lost Canyon area, and that's in Iowa. Talk a bit about that.
Mm-hmm. You know, I keep discovering, I'm in my early 50s, and I keep discovering new places that I have not known before. And Whitewater in Lost Canyon was one of those finds. It is a county wildlife refuge that is jointly run by Dubuque County, Jones County, and Jackson Counties. It falls right at the juncture of those counties. They, both of those areas were privately owned. In one case, I believe it might even have been a century farm. In the other case, a lesser time period. But both of those owners really felt that the beauty of their particular pieces of land needed to be shared with the broader public, and they didn't want to see it, say, developed into a housing development or whatnot. So they worked with the counties to establish them as wildlife refuges. And what's particularly unique about those couple of places, I mean, they're adjacent, is that basically they are remnants of caves that, in a sense, sort of blew their lids during the last ice age. That in some of these locations where you come across real sharp cliffs and angular cliffs, what you're looking at is an old cave waterway that, in a sense, caved in. And so at Whitewater, you're looking at about a 200-foot drop down into Whitewater Creek. Prior to the Ice Age, it was a cave. And then either just the intense cold caved it in, or perhaps the intense water when the glaciers started melting. And then at Lost Canyon, you're down in some areas where some of the side caves are still there. And there's one particular cave that I absolutely love. It's called the Ice Cave.
And I'm going to hold right there, and I'm going to ask you to hold on to that comment about the Ice Cave at Lost Canyon. Our guest today, Kevin Koch, author of The Driftless Land, and he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about the driftless area of our country, which includes Wisconsin, a good part of Wisconsin, parts of northeast part of Iowa, northwest Illinois, southeast Minnesota, written about by Kevin Koch. He has a series of essays that in his book, The Driftless Land, Spirit of Place in the Upper Mississippi Valley. Great to have him with us. And if you have questions about the driftless area or about his book, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And we'll get to Mike and Harmony Grove in just a minute here, but I first want to go back to Kevin. We were talking about Whitewater and Lost Canyon in Iowa. This is something that kind of intrigued me. And as we took a little break for news, you were talking about something that you really like as part of Lost Canyon, the Ice Cave.
Yes. Mm-hmm. First, Larry, are you hearing me all right?
Yes.
On your cell phone?
Okay,
yeah. Great. Yeah, when I first found out about Lost Canyon, I was talking to the Jones County Conservation Director, and he was telling me about an ice cave at Lost Canyon. And at first, I didn't think that much of it. There are a lot of little caves with that name. But I thought, well, I'll check it out. And I went out there one winter day with my snowshoes. It was actually the first time I had ventured out with snowshoes that I just bought. And off in the distance, I saw this cave with some hoarfrost above the mouth of the cave. I thought, I bet that's it. So I made my way up there. I had to climb up a little bit through some brambles and whatnot. And as I neared it, I could start to see all these little ice figures. And then as I got closer, the opening to the cave, the mouth of the cave, is probably about 6 to 8 feet wide and about 3 to 4 feet tall. And these ice figures were about 2 feet tall. They were like, in a sense, stalag stalactites, or stalagmites, only they were made from dripping water in ice, not the calcium. And they just had all these spooky human forms. they were just wonderful. And in the distance, in the background, I could hear water dripping in a corner of the cave. And it was just this plink, 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 just real haunting scene. So I've made that a spot that I return to every winter to check out the ice figures.
No, absolutely. It sounds like a wonderful spot. Mike and Harmony Grove, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hi. I had a question specifically about the Wisconsin Dells area. I used to drive, the river up in the Dells. I used to drive the tour boats back in college, so I'd spend every day driving up and down staring at these rocks. And I wondered if you could speak to the angling in some of the layers. I don't know how familiar with that specific area you are, but a lot of the rock is very horizontally layered. You can see layer after layer that was built. And then in amongst those, there's little pockets of angled rock where the striations are at somewhat of an angle back and forth. And I've never gotten a good reason as to how the rock formed that way under the sea, and I was curious if you knew anything about that.
Well, two caveats. First of all, I am not a geologist, and try to do my best and ask geologists to check my work. And the other is that I'm not real familiar with that particular area, but I'm guessing from what you're describing that we're probably looking at multiple layers of limestone, shale, and then some of the limestone having metamorphized into probably some layers of quartz. Different layers of the ancient seas will have deposited out as either more like a muddy shale that's in short little layers that break apart, or in sandstone, or in limestone that's more blocky. And then, again, like I say, the pressures of the earth can turn any of those sedimentary rocks into metamorphic rock, and so that's probably what you're seeing with the quartz.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Mike. Let's turn to Ann Dale from Jefferson. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question. I am interested in getting that book because it fascinates me, and I know what he's talking about, the Driftless area. I am curious, how many square miles are in each state that has the Driftless area, starting with Wisconsin?
Okay, we got about 20,000 square miles total.
Yeah, if I could, I probably can't answer that in terms of the square miles, how it breaks down, but in terms of the percentages, I think you'd find that
Wisconsin's
the,
got
the
a pretty
biggest,
big chunk.
Yeah, Wisconsin is the biggest chunk. I'd say probably about 60 to 75% of what we're talking about is in Wisconsin.
Okay, Wisconsin's the first. What state would be the second?
Toss up between Minnesota and Iowa. Iowa goes a longer stretch along the river, I would say. Minnesota, shorter stretch along the river, but just a little bit further inland.
So Iowa would be two and then Minnesota three. That's what I was curious. Because I've been through quite a bit of that area, and I know, but I wasn't sure just how much was in each of those states. I know Wisconsin has a huge section in the southern part and southwest, and I know just how beautiful it is. This whole state's beautiful, and so are the other three, or other two.
You got.
And I'm very interested in picking up your book. I hope that Walden Bookstores has it also, but I imagine it's in hardcover. Am I correct?
Yes, you.
No, just in paper.
And
it's
in
paper. Paperback.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good. That means
paper,
it's a little bit cheaper. Sorry, but when you're on a budget, low income, it helps.
Works for me.
I wonder if the libraries would have copies of it now.
I'm trying to connect with libraries, and hopefully they will. I know you can get it either directly. You know, online you can get it directly from Southeast Missouri State University Press or Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm sure your local bookstore If you go to your local bookstore, they can order a copy if they don't already have one.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Shireen in Springbrook, let's go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you. I grew up in Lancaster, but my favorite town was always Potosi.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's along like a coulee valley, and every house seemed to have a root cellar behind it where the caves went into the hillside. And it didn't have any through streets. It was like 3 miles long from the top of the highway till you got down to the mud flats.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it was, I always was wondering how they decided to build towns in these little places that I suppose they flooded even.
Yeah. Well, you talk a little bit about, maybe not necessarily, I don't remember if you talk about Potosi specifically, but you talk about some of the other towns, and I think in that context could discuss that question.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Could you repeat the question? I didn't quite pick it up.
She was wondering how the towns actually formed in these particular areas. Why a town might...
Okay, sure. I'm most familiar, as you might guess, with my own town of Dubuque, but it's the same for many of the towns along the Driftless. Some of the earliest arrivals were here for the lead mines, and of course that would be the Drew and Mineral Point as well. And so in my own particular area here, Julian Dubuque made arrangements both with the Meskwaki and with the governor of New Spain down in Louisiana to mine along the shore here. And then after his death in 1810, there was a little period of time where the land was not accessible to settlers with the unfortunate events of the Black Hawk War, which is just really a tragic massacre. After that time, in 1832, in a sense, the land was opened to settlers. And so in many of these regions, the first settlers, and this would be true in Potosi, too, because we have the lead mine museum.
Right.
Lead miners were... pretty much the first people in, and then, of course, followed by farmers and merchants. And
there you go. But the lead mines were often the genesis. Mm-hmm. Paul in La Crosse, thank you for calling. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I was just wondering, coming down Highway 35, I was looking at the bluffs, and on the Wisconsin side, they're all bare limestone. They look like cliffs. And on the Minnesota side, they're all tree-covered. And they're, you know, it's like they were all, I guess, originally part of the same formation, but why do they look so different? Why don't they match up in appearance?
Again, I'm going to use the same caveat that I'm not a geologist, and I always try to check my work against or with geologists, but to venture a guess there, you know, most of the Mississippi Valley. When you look across the two sets of bluffs, what you're basically looking at is what the Mississippi River would have looked like brim to brim during the melting period of the glaciers. And plus, add another 100 to 200 feet deep because there's that much glacial rubble at the bottom of the Mississippi. So Mississippi was running a good 400 or 500 feet deep as the glaciers melted, and that's an incredible amount of cutting power. It may have been that in those places that you're mentioning could have been perhaps on the outside of the edge of the current, and therefore getting the brunt of the the meltwater.
Oh, sure. That makes some sense.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Paul, for calling. Lee in Dodgeville, let's go to you now. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
Very interesting. I've always been fascinated with the Driftless area since I first came here 30-some-odd years ago. But my biggest thing, I'm a pilot, and I fly around southwest Wisconsin quite a bit. And it's always fascinating to be over the top of the Dells, that area, and see, and when you look on a section or on a map, of course, you're seeing how the Wisconsin River changes direction dramatically, just does this loop around the Dells there and then heads almost due west at that point. And I understand, I'm sorry I didn't hear the caveat earlier about you not having a geological background or not being a geologist, but it that whole process, it just turns it. The dynamic of the Dells in that in the glacial periods, that's what I'm interested in. Thanks.
All right.
What I understand about that area, and one of the essays in the book is called The Ice Age, because I figured if I was going to write about the Driftless area, I should have a piece about the glaciers. So, and what I understand, say that I'm getting the spot directly correct that you're referring to, but there was a, the Dells are sort of at the edge of a an ancient glacial lake, and it was dammed. The Wisconsin River flowed into that lake and was dammed essentially by an ice dam, an ice jam, which blocked up and created the lake. And when that ice dam eventually melted, you can just about imagine the rush of water that poured out of the ancient glacial lake, and I believe that speaks a lot to the different directions that the Wisconsin River takes as it makes its way down towards Mississippi.
Yeah, that must have been, you wouldn't want to have been in front of that when that dam broke.
That's right.
Oh, that was millions of gallons of water coming all at once.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Scott in Platteville, turning to you now. Hi, Scott.
Good afternoon. I'm a student up at the University of Platteville.
Okay.
And I'm also a cyclist. And one of the greatest little-known secrets is all the beautiful roads in the southwestern Wisconsin area.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the views and scenery you see along these roads with the mounds and the cliffs and the bluffs, it's just breathtaking. But some of my favorite parts is kind of between Platteville and Mount Horeb are all the mounds. And, you know, the Platteville Mound, Belmont Mound, and the infamous Blue Mound. You know anything on the formation of those? I know you're not a geologist like everybody's been saying, but
Actually, I did talk about that a little bit in the essay that's called Manitoumi Sinsinawa. But first I'm going to say I share your avid enjoyment of bicycling, especially in southwest Wisconsin. I bicycle over there a lot myself, and it's a great place for cycling. The mounds of Sinsinawa, Platteville, Blue Mound, and I'm missing one, they are, in a sense, the remnants of a Niagara limestone plateau that used to stretch all the way up, essentially, to the Niagara Falls. And it's a hard layer of rock that is, underneath it is a softer layer of shale. And through the ages, the rest of the area's Niagara limestone has essentially worn away because the shale has collapsed. And so what you have is just a few remnants of places where the Niagara limestone has remained intact in almost like the stepping stone formation working its way back up towards Niagara formation would be, you know, at surface level.
Mm.
That's where those come from.
Interesting. Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling, Scott. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 with your question or comment. Let's turn to Andrew in Madison. Hi, Andrew.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm a geologist, and I just wanted to call and see if I could comment a little bit on the question the gentleman had about the Wisconsin Dells.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Good.
I believe what he was referring to is the Cambrian Age sandstone that you can see along the Wisconsin River in the upper and lower Dells. And those were actually formed by wind-blown sand dunes. So So if you can, you know, if you think about the way a sand dune forms, wind blows the sand up one side of the dune, and then it spills over the backside. So you have tilted surfaces of the dunes, and that's how you get those angled layers in that sandstone.
Excellent.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call as well. Before we go back to the phones, I should have asked this right off the beginning, but for you to just tell us a little more about your book itself. It's a series of essays, but give our listeners more of an idea about what they're going to find in the book.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I like to think of there are 18 essays in the book, and about a dozen of them are what is often called literary journalism. Those are pieces that are researched or interviewed, but they are also contain a narrative thread. So, for example, in the Mississippi Refuge, I had the opportunity to go out on the river with the gentleman I mentioned, John Straver.
John Straver, yeah.
Right. And there's another piece on the Savannah Army Depot where I had the opportunity to do some bird banding with a member of the Illinois DNR. And so they mingle information about the area, geologic, human history, description of the areas, along with the story of being out in the place. And then some of the other essays are more of the narrative mode or memoir mode, a smaller number, but these would be, for example, the seasonal essays of spring here, summer here, autumn and winter. And in each of those, there is oftentimes a particular image that strikes me that will be kind of central to the essay about the season. And a couple of other types as well.
All right, let's go back to the phones and to Celeste and Sabin. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. I'm calling today because actually I moved into the area in 1986, but I live around the Gays Mills, Wisconsin area.
Yeah.
And there we have a very wonderful festival. If people want to bike there or motorcycle or whatever, every year this will be our 52nd Apple Fest in the Gays Mills area. You can see the orchards on the hills. You can enjoy the valleys. It's always held the last weekend of September, the 25th and 26th. And it's a wonderful time. We have people from all over that come, especially from Minnesota and Iowa and everyone. We've had a lot of different people that are authors, such as Pearl Swigum and others that have come to our festival and enjoyed. And I just wanted to welcome people. It's such a beautiful place to live.
Oh, it is. It's the last weekend of September.
Yes, it is.
Sounds great.
Yeah, it's and that Gays Mills area is, I really, really like driving through that area. I'm sure you've been through there, Kevin. It's thanks again, Celeste. So that's the last weekend of September, the Apple Fest and Flea Market, I believe, as well. John in Lake Geneva, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you, Larry, Kevin? Great talk you guys got going today. Thank you for taking my call. I just have more of a comment for you. For 31 years, our fathers, I myself am 30 years old, but our fathers have been doing a motorcycle ride through the area called the Tri-State River Ride. And it's about a 700-mile motorcycle ride. And we actually come from Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, to the Dells, to La Crosse, to Dubuque, back to Lake Geneva. And I'll tell you what, it is a little-known secret. It was absolutely gorgeous this weekend. And we do it the same weekend, this first weekend after Labor Day, and it's just gorgeous.
Well, that's what brings people to the area, isn't it, Kevin? It's just so beautiful, so different.
Yeah, it is. It's like an island in the and you know, I've come to love the prairie as well. It took me a while in my life to learn that, and I learned it from in particular from a colleague of mine here at Loras. But nevertheless, this is sort of an island in the midst of the Midwest, and it's very different from what most people on the outside of the Midwest envision when they think of the Midwest.
Absolutely. And you've written a nice book here. Thank you so much, Kevin, for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for talking with me.
Kevin Koch, last name is spelled K-O-C-H, by the way. And the title of his book is The Driftless Land, Spirit of Place in the Upper Mississippi Valley. And you can get it from your local bookstore or go to the press. It's published by Southeast Missouri State University Press. Southeast Missouri State University Press. Thanks to him for being with us. Tomorrow we'll talk canoeing and science with Sarah Granger, Water Quality Program Manager for the Valley Stewardship Network, one of our guests tomorrow. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.